sometimes you get caught kind of asking the questions why, don't you? You know, it's like a three-year-old, you start asking the questions. And I was walking up to church recently and I was thinking, why? Why do I go to church? You know, why do I spend my Sunday mornings with you delightful people? And then when we get here, we do this most unusual things. I don't know anybody else who gets together on a morning, whether or an evening, whatever it is, and they tell some stories and have a cup of coffee, and then they sing songs. I mean, people, choirs do that, and people love that, and that's really good. And then they pray, and then, get this, right? They get the same book out every week, the same book, and they have a little lecture on it, right? If you went to a book club and they said, welcome to this book club, we only do The Lord of the Rings. That's all we ever do. We just read it, and then we go through it, and then we read it again, and then we read it again, and we read it again. That's all we're doing. We pick up the same book, and we encounter, read it, and look at it every week. Why do we do that? We get this weird thing called a sermon as well, which goes with it. And I believe strongly and passionately that the reading of the scriptures is important, publicly, privately, and the preaching of the scriptures and exploration of it is critical as well. And the reason I believe that is because as human beings, both individually and collectively, we have a wonderful gift to make the world in our own image. We shape our imaginations of who we are and who others are, who we might be, whoever the we is, by our fears, our expectation, our experience. And we do the same with gods. And this is called idolatry. We create gods in our own image. It's something that we've been doing since the history of humanity. And the frightening thing is, we could do the same with Jesus. We could do the same with the God that we encounter through Jesus. We can shape him and form him and ask him to do things and put ideas and descriptions upon him that have nothing to do with him. And that's why we return each week to the scriptures, because the scriptures testify, we believe, to a God who loves us and made himself known in Jesus. And if we don't return to the scriptures, we run the great and grave risk of knowing and loving and talking about Jesus that is not revealed here, and actually making Jesus into an idol of our own formation. So that's why I'm excited about opening the scriptures. And I hope that we together can be excited about exploring this portion of the scriptures together. Now I'm just going to read you this passage. I'm in Luke 19, starting at 28 to 48. Beforehand, let me just... we'll just read the scriptures first. Now, talk. So if you want to follow the Bible, you can do, or you can just listen. Jesus comes to Jerusalem as king is the title that's given the NIV. As Jesus had said this, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. As he approached Bethphage and Bethany on the hill called the Mount of Olives, he sent two disciples, saying to them, go ahead to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you will find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you why you're untying it, say, the Lord needs it. Those who were sent ahead went and found as he told them. As they were untying the colt, the answers asked them, why are you untying the colt? They replied, the Lord needs it. That obviously went down because they didn't ask any other questions. They brought it to Jesus, threw their cloaks on the colt, and put Jesus on it. As he went along, people spread their cloaks on the road. When he came to a place where the road goes down to the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise the Lord in loud voices for all the miracles they'd seen. They said, blessed is a king who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest. Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to Jesus, teacher, rebuke your disciples. I tell you, he replied, if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out. As he approached Jerusalem, he saw the city. He wept over it and said, if you, even you, had known to this day, or known on this day, what would bring you peace? But now it is hidden from your eyes. The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you down to the ground, you and your children within your walls. They will leave not one stone on another, because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. When Jesus entered the temple courts, he began to drive out those who were selling. It is written, he said, My house will be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers. Every day he was teaching at the temple, but the chief priests and teachers of the law and the leaders among the people were trying to kill him. Yet they could not find any way to do it because all the people hung on his words. So this is the second half of Luke 19, as I said, and it's following on from the passage that John looked at last week in this on our big series that we're doing on Luke. And last week, John specifically focused on the story of Zacchaeus, but it also had the parable of the 10 minas, the talents that were given out. And this is a crucial part of Luke as a transition in the book of Luke. Luke can be considered to be made up in three sections. The first section is Jesus' birth, John the Baptist's birth, his calling of disciples, so Jesus' baptism, the initial calling of disciples, and what you might say, the forming of a people of God, Jesus' people. And that is in all sorts of ways. He goes and heals people, the lost and the least and the last in society. And he begins to talk. He has Luke's version of the Sermon on the Mount is found in this section. And then it transitions. It transitions when Jesus asks a question to the disciples following one of his teachings. He says, but who do you say I am? And Peter says, you are the Christ. You're the Messiah. And at that point, Jesus the first time foretells that he will go to Jerusalem to die. And this section starts the next time, which is traditionally called the Journey to Jerusalem. It's a very long journey. And that's what we've been doing for months, well, weeks, probably months, yeah. As he goes along, and this journey in the book of Luke walks along, and it meets all sorts of people. And there's lots of meals with saints and meals with sinners. And there's lots of teaching, loads of parables. I've preached on this section three times, I think, and I've preached on three parables. In the book of Luke, this is where the predominant bit of Jesus' teaching is. And last week, we finished that section as Jesus went to Jericho, which is the bottom of the hill near the Dead Sea. He preached, he went to Zacchaeus' house. And then this week, as I read, he goes up the Mount of Olives. And so, just to set a scene, I think it's fascinating. I've been to the Dead Sea on the Syrian side. I've looked into Israel, but my parents and myself, when I was growing up in the Middle East, we couldn't go to Israel because then the stamp of Israel would be on our stamps, on our passports, and we'd no longer be received in the Middle East, or we'd have a lot of problems with it. So we were on the Syrian side, and it's obviously way before the war, and I could see into Israel. And I've been down to the Dead Sea, and it is dead. It is dead. Everything around it is dead. It's like a sea on the bottom of a desert. It's 200, it's the lowest bit of the earth, and it's 200, like 200 plus meters below sea level. Jericho is in the same valley, still there today. And you start from Jericho, and it's dry and it's dusty all year round. There's hardly any rain there. And you climb up this big escarpment. It's about 14 miles, and it's about the height of a Munro from the beginning of Jericho up to the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. And so Jesus walks up this hill. He probably does it in a day. This is, of course, the road where the story of the Good Samaritan is set. On that same road. So he's walking in the stories he's been telling. He's walking up the road, and then you get to the Mount of Olives. Now, it's springtime at this time at Passover, and the Mount of Olives is covered with trees full of leaves. So you've gone from the desert to the green. And the Mount of Olives, he enters into Jerusalem, but he does something very odd, doesn't he? He goes and gets a donkey, or a colt. And it's not because he's tired. I mean, you would be tired, it's quite a long walk, but it's not because he's tired. It's because he wants to say something. Now, in all the bit in Luke I've been telling you about, especially in the road to, on the journey to Jerusalem, he's been speaking explicitly to his disciples behind closed doors that he is the Messiah. Now, they haven't really necessarily got it, we find out in Luke. But they begin to understand that Jesus has been explicitly speaking about that. But in the crowds, he's been saying it in secret. He's been saying it, you can imply it through what he says. The other Gospels talk about how the crowd want to make him the Messiah. And he has to slip away. But he's not been overt in his statement that he's the Messiah publicly. But here, he announces it. This is it. Because he goes and gets a donkey. Now, it's not a normal way you'd think you'd be able to announce your kingship, would it? But the reason it is because it comes from a specific, speaks to and points to a specific biblical passage. And that's in Zechariah 9, verse 11. And the verse says there, your king will come to you riding on a donkey. And so when somebody who is a leader in Israel picks up a donkey and walks the gates of Jerusalem, it basically says, I'm he. I am your Messiah. So it's an overt statement of who he is and what he's about to do. And the people get excited. His disciples get excited. They're like, yes, we're going public. Boom, it's happening, guys. And then his followers, they've also maybe gone, well, we thought it was going to happen, but now we're good to go. And then there'd be a whole bunch of people who would just be desperate for Messiah. It doesn't matter who he was. Be like, oh, there's a Messiah in town. Boom, get rid of the Romans. It doesn't matter who he is, but I want a Messiah. That's what I want. So let's go and join in. There's other people who just want to sing and shout and put their clothes on the ground, which is kind of odd. But they go along and they start shouting and beginning to call out, and there's a crowd gathered, and they begin to say these things. They say, blessed is a king who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. And that first line is a direct quote from Psalm 18. And for those who are interested, and I love things like this, this comes from Psalm 18, and Psalm 18 goes along with Psalms 113 to 118 are a group of psalms called the Hallel psalms, and they're traditionally sung at festivals. And here we are at Passover. So they're singing from the song sheet. They've got the song sheet out. They would have actually memorized it because they knew all the psalms off by heart. But they were singing from the song sheet, and they choose a line from their song sheet from the festival time to a point to put to Jesus. So off they go, and they begin to sing this song. And then we get the Pharisee said, teacher, rebuke your disciples. Now, maybe this Pharisees, I mean, it's pretty obvious what Jesus is doing. It's not like confusing, but maybe the Pharisees kind of giving him the benefit of doubt. Maybe Jesus is saying something else, and it's a bit embarrassing for him, and maybe he didn't realize that like donkeys and hills and walking to Jerusalem is a big thing. But, you know, just in case they give him a second chance, you know, Jesus, do you know what's happening here? You need to rebuke your disciples. And Jesus says, no. Jesus makes his claim emphatic to the Pharisees. It's fascinating, in this section here, we have all the stratosphere, all the layers of Jewish leadership. We have the Pharisees, the chief priests, the leaders, the teachers of the law, and the leaders amongst the people. These are the four major groups of Israel society, and they're all represented in this passage. And Jesus confronts every single one of them. So, he rejects that. And then he's still on the road, and we forget this, we're still on the road, and then Luke's like kind of pans, it's like, I think it's a bit of a camera shot. He like pans to his face. There's a crowd going on, there's singing, there's dancing, there's clothes being thrown on the ground. Other Gospels talk about boughs of trees being thrown down, which interestingly is a verse in Psalm 118, just a few verses later. It talks about bring your branches with you to Jerusalem, throw them down. So again, the branch would have been a sign, a symbol of who Jesus was. And his face is weeping because he's seen Jerusalem. And we have this beautiful section, challenging section, interesting section. I just want to read it out again. As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, if you, even you, had known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it's hidden from your eyes. The days will come to you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and circle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and your children within your walls. And they will leave not one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. This is an interesting little passage, little section. And it's been variously interpreted throughout time. Some people think that Jesus is talking about the end times. But I think actually we can see very clearly in terms of the context, in terms of what he's talking about, in terms of his exact description, that he's talking about the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So I love that sort of stuff, but you probably aren't going to know your sort of Jewish history of this time. But the whole history, the sort of the environment Jesus is born into is rich with revolution. There's rebels and risings against the ruling powers of the time. There had been the Greeks, and there'd been rebellions against them, some successful by Jewish people. Then there were the Romans. I mean, Jesus comes from Galilee and Nazareth, the other way around. And before he was born, there was a man called Judas who rose up in Galilee and was a leader against the Romans, and he was eventually crushed. So in his own region, someone very recent, in recent times, had risen up against the Romans. I mean, there was the Zealots, who were the people who were violently opposed to Rome and would take up arms. They justified theologically the taking up arms against the Romans. And he had one of them as his disciples. So, you know, he's right in the midst of this environment. And what happens after Jesus is that this rebellion, this spirit rebellion, rises up, bubbles up, people journey up. And eventually, in AD 66, there's a tax law that's put in. There's rebellion against it. The Jewish people fight against the Roman tax law. And what happens is the Romans break into the temple complex and they remove money they believe that's owed to them. Now, obviously, the temple is sacred. It's a central symbol of Israel and the Jewish people. And this causes, amongst all the other things, the spark point for a rebellion against the Romans. And the Jews of that time are successful. They chuck them out of Jerusalem, let's say Rome, not Jerusalem, Rome, Jerusalem, and they create a small republic. Now, this is led by three people, and it's all going very well. But of course, if you know history, you know the Romans don't usually forget. The Romans usually just like get some big legions, they get some roads, and they fill up, and they go and destroy people. And the Romans don't forget. They come back, and they encircle the city. They actually build walls around the city to stop any food coming into the city. And they begin to build these huge embankments, literally the size of the city walls, as they would do. And inside the city, it wasn't well organized. There was three leaders. There was three principal leaders at that time. And there was no one single person. And they began to do crazy things like burn their supplies to encourage the inhabitants of the city to fight more virulently, you know, to fight for their city. And the Romans keep on coming. They keep on building. And eventually they break through the walls. I think it's 3 or 4 days it takes them to take the whole entire city. They don't. The Roman historians appear to say they didn't want to destroy the temple, but the temple is actually destroyed. It goes into fire. It burns down. The people, the armies fight. They keep on closing walls. The Romans have knocked down that wall and turned into the city, and they break another wall, and they break down. And eventually, the entire city is destroyed. Historians, it's difficult to tell, say 92,000 people were taken into slavery, sold as gladiators and farm slaves, and that tens of thousands of people were killed at that time. It talks about they're so angry, so they want to make a symbol of Jerusalem. The Romans take down the walls, not all the walls, but take down some of the walls. They even take all the walls down, and they start taking the foundation stones, so the stones that are below the ground. They take them out, so no one even know where the walls were. And this echoes exactly what Jesus says. He weeps because he sees that his people are going to reject him and reject his message of peace, reject his message of the kingdom. And the result of that is that he knows. Now, it's difficult to tell whether, I mean, just on human terms, you could say that Jesus could say, well, if you set yourself on this path, there's only one way it's going to go. And that's going to be rebellion against Romans, and they will beat you. Or I think also, as he has shown in many times through the Gospels, it's a prophetic word. This is going to happen. But whatever it is, he sees that the rejection of his message and his gospel of peace and the kingdom of God is going to bring about Jerusalem's destruction. So then he goes on up the hill. We'll return to that, but he goes up the hill. It doesn't say he gets off the donkey, but he must do it at some point. And eventually he enters the temple courts. And he begins to drive out those who are selling. Now, what happened is the temple courts is like the inner section and then the slightly out section and the bigger section. It's like things of an onion, that's right, isn't it? And certain people were allowed certain things, like the Holy of Holies, only one priest would go in once a year. And the next section, only the priest would go. And the next section, only Jewish males would go. And the next section, only Gentiles and women, Jewish women could go. And it's now this outer court, I believe, that they had these sellers. And what they were doing was, these are men selling, being money exchangers. So people, Jews lived all across the empire, and they'd come with all the different money, and they'd swap it in for temple money. That money was only good in the temple. And that money would then buy sacrifices and other things. And so there was this the place. And so what happened, of course, it meant for the women, Jewish women and the Gentiles, they wouldn't be able to pray in quite the same way. And so he goes in to the temple. And this is just as obvious and just as clear as his taking the colt. He says, I'm in charge. Who gets to clean your house? You get to clean your house because it's your house. If I came into your house and started cleaning it, you might be pleased. Or you might just say, what right do you have to clean my house? What right do you have to paint the walls differently? What right to chuck that sofa away? This is my house. And Jesus comes in and says, I'm cleaning up this house. So he's taking authority over the temple. So he throws the tables over and he says this, my house shall be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers. Now, I'd love to tell you lots and lots about the different passages he took to, but the second one particularly is really amazing because it's a direct quote from Jeremiah 7:11. And the amazing thing about Jeremiah 7, so go home and read it, is it's like an exact parable. Jeremiah, like he does, he's sort of sitting there and God says, go and do stuff. And Jeremiah does it. It's just brilliant. And he does all sorts of weird stuff. But one of the days he goes, go to temple courts, stand on the temple steps and say this. You are doing things that are destructive to your relationship with me, to each other, and to those in the world. You're following other gods. You're committing adultery. You're mistreating your slaves. You're breaking all the Ten Commandments. And yet, you run back to temple and we're safe, everything's good. God lives amongst us, we'll all be fine. And Jeremiah says, no. The way you're going, the path is going to lead to your destruction. It's time to turn. It's exactly the same message as Jesus. You have chosen, if you reject my message, you've chosen a path of destruction. And Jeremiah says, you've made it a den of robbers. And Jesus quotes him directly. And it's quite cool because he'd be literally standing, not on the same steps because they're two different temples. Jeremiah prophesied that the temple would fall, the city would fall. And indeed it did. So that temple was destroyed. And Jesus is standing on the steps of Herod's temple that was built quite recent to when he was born. It says the same thing. Every day he was then teaching the temple, it says. But the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the leaders amongst the people were trying to kill him. Yet they could not find any way to do it because all the people hung on his words. This one passage, in sort of socio-political terms, is the reason why Jesus died on the cross. So he made two, you know, extreme statements of his messiahship. He rode a donkey into Jerusalem, and then he went into the temple and said, I'm in charge. Now, the chief priests, they ran the temple. They were in charge of it. That was their center of power. If they ran the temple, that was the most important part of Jerusalem. That was the center of their power. And Jesus walked right past them and said, I'm in charge of this place. And this is what I think about the way you're running it. So these two acts were the two reasons, were the reasons why, they're like the last straw that broke the camel back. Why? Not only the religious leaders it talks about here, so the chief priests, the teacher of law, another subgroup, and then the leaders among the people, so not religious people, they decided that this statement that Jesus made about his messiahship, that he must go, he must die. And then Jesus begins to teach the temple. And what we're going to discover in Luke is, in the next few passages we look at, is his teaching in the temple, what he's saying. It's fascinating that authority is the first thing that he talks about, which is exactly that issue. He talks about John the Baptist, as we're going to discover. So I said at the beginning that I want to know more about Jesus. And hopefully we have learned a little bit more about Jesus, but let's explore and push in a little bit more about what that might mean for us. Hopefully we can take lots of different things. One of the wonderful things about a sermon is I spend some time preaching and thinking about it. That I was hearing this morning, Paul and Roland, their life group, was looking at this passage this week and brought out different things and discussed it. And then I give a sermon and you forget it and change it and remember different things. And months later, John and I were laughing at this. A month later, you get someone says, you know that thing you said 3 months ago? And you're like, I don't think I ever said that. That's been amazing. That's really just transformed things. You're like, wow, isn't that good? God does whatever he wants with the stuff that we say. And he sort of shakes it out and brings it together. But then the sermon doesn't stop today. The sermon carries on because you go home and you read the passage and maybe you go to your life group and you look at the passage again and you open up and you discuss it and you begin to think about what's been said. And so today is not the end of the sermon. Today is just the beginning of the sermon and something we want to carry on. So let me start by pointing out a few things. There's loads of other stuff that we could point out. But the stuff that really struck me as I look at this passage really hinges on this central section as he weeps over Jerusalem. I want to start with an illustration though. So amongst this day is Jack Pride. And if you've ever been on Jack, well, Jack, give us a wave. There he is. Jack does many, many different things, but one of the things he does is tours around Dunfermline, around the history of Dunfermline. And a few years ago, our life group joined another life group, and we went on Jack's tour around Dunfermline, and then we went for a meal in Cafe 42? Grill 48, that's it, something like that. It was really good. I don't know if it's still happening, but I know Jack still does his tour, so you can speak to him about it. But I'll tell you this. One of the best things about that tour I remember is Jack went around and said, oh, you know, it used to be this building here and this building here. But one of the things I remember is standing at the entrance of the bus station, and we're looking at the back of the houses. And he pointed to a house, and he said, see that room? There, in that room, in that house, was an Italian. And then he went on to tell a story all about this family. And that he went to school, am I right, something like that. There was this really fine detail. And as he went around the town, he told the stories of the buildings. But what really struck me was the story of the people he knew, the people he didn't know. But what comes so clearly through it is his deep love for Dunfermline. Not only for the fabric of it, but for the stories, for the people that inhabit it. And he talks in passion as well about the future Dunfermline. He's a man who's passionate about his time. And what we see here with Jesus is that he deeply loves Jerusalem. This is not just some sort of, you know, he's not floating through life and thinking, oh, isn't that a shame? You know, Jerusalem's going to fall. He profoundly and deeply loves Jerusalem. And I think he loves the people there. But you know what? I think he also loves the places. He's been going there since he's a kid. You know, he was there in the temple courts, his parents left. He could tell you where his favorite baker is. He could tell you where his favorite accommodation was when they stay, when they come for the festivals. He could tell you his favorite part of the temple complex. He could tell you about which place is best to get good drinking water. Jesus knew the stones of Jerusalem. He knew about that family, the Italian family. Well, you know, the equivalent one. Who always, you know, it's always passionate and there's always arguments, but they're all made up and hugged at the end. He could tell you about the people of Jerusalem. And it broke his heart. It broke his heart to see what was going to happen. It broke his heart. And I think it's something significant about that. We sometimes imagine Jesus sort of floating through life. He's always got his picture. We've got this imagination that Jesus is always like, well, the big, huge, universal, cosmic, amazing thing that's going to happen is going to be my death and resurrection. And of course that's true. But we don't just get his death and resurrection. We get his life. We get to see a man who's deeply, deeply embedded in his time and his culture, who loves the people around him just as he loves us. But if he was a man who didn't love his time, that would be concerning, wouldn't it? Because how could I trust that he loved our time? How could he trust that he loved me and the ridiculously minutiae of my life? But no, Jesus loves his time, his people, his place, the streets that are going to fall. The next thing I want to point out is that he's deeply emotional. Jesus doesn't, as I say, float through life. He feels and lives deeply. I would argue that that Jesus experienced in this last week of his life and then his resurrection, what could only be described the full like gambit of humanity's experience. In that 1 week, he's going to receive the adulation at the beginning. He's going to receive, people are going to misunderstanding him. People are going to betray him. People are going to leave him alone, his closest friends. He's going to be all sorts of different things going on there. Then physically, he's going to be beaten. He's going to be stripped. He's going to be mocked. He's going to die publicly. And then he's going to do something no one else has ever done before. He's going to defeat death. So you can't like have more in terms of like a spectrum of a week. And he doesn't float through it. He walks through some and tears pour down his face. And I think it's important because sometimes we think that if we're too happy or too sad or we feel too deeply, there's something maybe wrong with us. That this isn't the way. Like to be a good Jesus disciple is that we can just sort of float through life. That like we're so assured of where we're going and so assured of all that, that we don't need to really feel. And we would love that because life is sometimes unbelievably difficult. And we would love to escape that. And so we hope that. But I don't think it's true. I don't think that's what we see in Jesus. And I don't think it's what he has for us. Because I think that's actually a sad imitation of a life. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a German churchman and theologian who stood up to Nazis in his time and eventually died for it, said this. Christians do not have an ultimate escape route out of their earthly tasks and difficulties into eternity. Like Christ, they have to drink the cup of earthly life to the last drop. And only when they do this is the crucified and risen one with them, and they are crucified and resurrected with Christ. He's a man speaking in midst of great difficulty, so I might add something to his statement here. Christians do not have an ultimate escape route out of their earthly tasks, difficulties, and joys, and laughter, the ups and the downs, into eternity. Like Christ, they have to drink the cup of earthly life to the last drop. Jesus drank the earthly life that he was given to the last drop for us all. And when we follow him, He asks us to follow him in that way. And that is profoundly challenging, but also profoundly encouraging, because he doesn't just like send us off, that he goes with us and enables us. The last thing I want to point out in this section that comes in this middle bit here is the nature of the kingdom that he's at work in. It says here at the beginning in 42, if you had known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it's hidden in your eyes. So what Jesus announces through his kingdom of God, through his kingdom message, would have given Jerusalem peace if they'd responded. Would have transformed Israel's identity, its role in society and the wider world, and would have become what it's supposed to be, a beacon to the light, for light to Gentiles. If they had responded to it, peace may have come. And the last bit of that section says, you will not leave one stone another, because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. And so Jesus connects God's presence and God's peace together. And we find the end of the gospel, when Jesus has resurrected, what does he leave with them? He leaves with him his peace. And so we are going to see, we see in this passage Jesus' judgment. Jesus goes to the temple and he judges the temple. And we're going to see passages about judgment. But what's important, I think, to also capture is the judgment comes in order to establish a kingdom of peace. The end goal is a kingdom of peace. That's what we're called to. That's what we're part of. Jesus wants to enable that. And actually, if you think about it, if you want a kingdom of peace, there has to be judgment. Things have to be put right. Things have to be called. That's not good, and that is good. And that's how you establish a kingdom of peace. And Jesus, that's what we're walking towards when he comes again. It's not part of the passage here, but in the rest of the scriptures, it talks about Jesus coming again and establishing a kingdom of peace. What happens before that? His judgment. But he comes to establish a kingdom of peace. But in the meantime, God's peace and his presence are synonymous with each other. So when we're with him, we might know his peace. He gives his disciples his peace. It doesn't mean that disciples are not going to face confusion and difficulty. If you know the story about disciples in Acts, which is the second part of Luke, they're going to face all sorts of difficulties. Many, all of them are going to die, bar one, we think, possibly, unnatural deaths caused by others. But he gave them peace to walk deeply in the midst of life in their time and their place. And when we're with him, he brings us peace too. Not that we might escape from this life, but that we might walk faithfully with him and know his presence as we testify to him and all that he does. Hopefully there's something there. I really always try and preach in such a way that I don't answer and give you all the things. I want for us to start a meal. I've given you the starter. And now's a chance for us to get into it, get into the main course. And I invite you not to eat this meal by yourself. Eat it with the life group, eat it with friends. Listen to the scriptures, read another translation. But get into it. This is a meal. This is the starting on a Sunday of what we do. And then we've got a chance to live it out and work it.